the Rudy Valley Hour. Hi-ho, everybody. This is Rudy Valley and Company. Each week as we stand here on the springboard of the hour, with time's nudging finger in our ribs, we face radio's characteristic challenge. To wit, now or never. The movies can make 1,000 retakes. In radio, things have to be right the first time. So we face the opening curtain, no matter how many times we've faced it before, with a degree of trepidation and doubt. The size and seriousness of our doubts vary tremendously. This week, for instance, we are more than usually confident that our week of preparation will result in an hour of satisfaction to all concerned. Our claims to your attention include a thoroughly unusual short play with an ingenious conclusion, a finish that will give you something to argue about long after the close of the hour. The play, Professor Gossamer's Experiment. The players, Donald Meek and Elizabeth Patterson. You will be made acquainted, moreover, with one of America's most popular novelists, Zane Grey. Courting your elusive chuckles in our behalf this evening are Paul Gerritz, with an assortment of sharp-breaking anecdotes, the bucolic Barney Grant, whose hillbilly humors you enjoyed in our San Francisco show, and the King's Men, who have hitherto been hidden in the comparative obscurity of our vocal ensemble. Said ensemble is again headed this week by Jane Warren. You may strike when ready, Mr. Heaston. The Rudy Valley Hour. Act One, presented by the makers of Royal Desserts, Royal Gelatin, and Royal Puddings.
Lovely debutante, you are so alluring. In your dainty gown, how you tantalize. Lovely debutante, though you seem demurring, there's a sweet surprise in your dreamy eyes. Though your lips may hold a secret, you're trying to hide. Mr. Cupid knows the secret. A lucky boy, a happy bride. Lovely debutante, with your charms enduring, may you always be as you are tonight.
Our popular potpourri this week includes Lovely Debutante, the continental hit Marilou, and What Do You Know About Love?
How can you love me and be so untrue? Oh, what do you know about love? You say you mean it, how happy we'll be. But how can you mean it and be mean to me? Oh, what do you know about love? It's funny when you hold me tight, it thrills me so much it's a sin. But sweetheart, when you hold me tight, that isn't love, it's the mood that you're in. I'd like to believe you that we'll never part. How can I believe you when you break my heart? Oh, what do you know about love?
It takes all kinds of people to make a town like this, Hollywood. And a great many of them live in Pasadena, which serves Hollywood in the capacity of railroad station, society center, and Rose Bowl. One of Pasadena's leading citizens is our guest of honor tonight, Zane Grey, author of vastly popular Western tales and equally eminent catcher of extremely large fish. We shall explore Mr. Grey's views on fiction and fishing forthwith. This is Zane Grey. A brief biographical beginning seems to be indicated, Mr. Grey. Were you born out here in the West?
No, Mr. Valley. Zanesville, Ohio is my hometown. My folks were descendants of the pioneer Zane family.
Have you always wanted to be a writer?
Always. I have never considered doing anything else as long as I can remember. I wrote stories when I was a boy in Ohio. At the University of Pennsylvania, I wrote stories and played baseball. Now I write stories and fish. I hope I shall continue to do both for a good many years to come.
A hope that finds several million echoes tonight, Mr. Grey. How did you happen to devote yourself to Western stories?
When I was a young man, Mr. Valley, I had a decided taste for adventure. Still have, for that matter. Among my acquaintances was an old hunter, Buffalo Jones, who specially was roping buffalo and mountain lions. As far as I know, Buffalo Jones was the first man to hunt lions with a rope.
I remember seeing it done in a movie shot recently.
Well, Buffalo invented the technique some years before movies were heard of. He came east looking for someone to take photographs of him at work, and to write the story of his adventures. I got the job, went out west with Buffalo, and fell in love with the country. I have been writing about it ever since.
How many books have you written, Mr. Grey?
60. Almost all of them are the type condescendingly referred to as horse operas by our more sophisticated people these days. I rather resent that attitude, Mr. Valley. I can't get really angry, though, because I am secure in the knowledge that my own work is a sincere expression of myself. And that's what matters.
To thine own self be true, and it follows as night the day.
You make a peculiar Polonius, my boy. But that's the general idea. I have always been an admirer of action. If my books are novels of action rather than expression of mental indigestion, well, that's natural and honest. Moreover, there's no story worthy of the telling than the story of the winning of the American West. That's the story I've been trying to write for some time.
What about the future of the West, now that there's no more frontier?
Who says there are no more frontier, Mr. Valley? I can take you tomorrow to as wild a country as any you've ever read about. And it's not so many miles back of the Hollywood Hills. On open cattle ranges, for example, we're still pestered by ordinary rustlers. They use auto trucks nowadays, but they're rustlers, nevertheless, and exceedingly tough gentlemen.
But there's no more free land, and I've heard about cowboys rounding up cattle in Fords and listening to Toscanini in the car's radio while they work. I've sort of gathered the impression that the Old West is gone forever.
You're wrong about free land. There are still plenty of places to homestead in the West, and there are still vast undeveloped territories. The Old West is vanishing, of course, in the natural march of events. But the spirit of the men who made the West is still very much alive. Considering the direction in which international events have been marching lately, it is quite possible that the last hope of the world may reside in that intensely American, intensely dramatic spirit. But I'm afraid we're getting pretty ponderous.
Possibly. How about fishing?
What about fishing?
Well, I'm not so much of a fisherman myself, Mr. Gray. In fact, I've often wondered just why people get all wrapped up in it. Why do you fish?
It gives me a chance to think about my writing. At least that's what I tell myself. My wife would tell you I fish because I love fishing.
I'm afraid fishing has always seemed rather dull to me. I prefer tennis.
My boy, you utter blasphemy. Let me tell you, there's nothing dull about what happens when you have a 1,000-pound marlin at the end of a 39-thread line.
4-ounce perches, more my size. I suppose deep-sea fishing is different.
You suppose correctly. Swordfish, marlin, tuna, there you have an opponent worthy of any man's steel.
But don't you have to sit around for hours waiting for a bite?
Sometimes. Off Tahiti once, I fished for 83 consecutive days without a single strike.
And then went home?
No, sir. On the 84th day, I caught the biggest marlin anyone has ever caught before or since. It took 7 hours to land him, and he weighed 1,040 pounds, minus a large part of his tail. A shark got that during the final stages of the battle.
What do you use for bait when you go out for these mammoths of the deep? Not worms, I imagine.
No, definitely not worms. That particular mammoth took a 12-pound bonita.
How much did you say this marlin weighed?
Just over 1,000 pounds. I've hooked bigger fish, but that's the biggest one I ever caught.
I see. The big ones always get away.
That's true. It is also true that hope springs eternal in the human breast. Your true fisherman is always sure that next time the big one won't get away.
Have you ever seen a sea serpent, Mr. Gray?
At the risk of casting doubt on everything I've said thus far, Mr. Valley, the answer to that one must be yes. I have seen a sea serpent.
Where?
Near Galapagos in 1926. If it wasn't a sea serpent, I don't know what it could have been. It looked like a sea serpent. Many reliable people have reported seeing huge serpent-like creatures in the sea. I'm sure some of them exist.
Well, now that you've seen a sea serpent, caught a world's record marlin and written 60 books, what are your plans for the future?
I expect to continue to write and fish in the order named, Mr. Valley. I'm working now on a romance of Western Union, and I expect to fish the Indian Ocean soon, that being the only sizable body of water I've missed today.
Good luck in both ventures, Mr. Gray, and my sincere thanks for the many hours of enjoyment your books have given me.
Thank you, Mr. Valley.
This week, your grocer invites you to...
When the givers of movie laurels make their annual awards for the best supporting performances of 1938, they must, we warn them, reserve extremely serious consideration for two marvelously capable players, Donald Meek and Elizabeth Patterson. You'll remember the delightful little man who manufactured trick rabbits in You Can't Take It With You. That was Donald Meek, to mention one other standout part among hundreds. He was also the terrified tailor in The Informer some years ago. And Miss Patterson, if you saw Paramount Sing You Sinners, you won't fail to recall the mother role, an acting gem if there ever was one. She is currently visible in Bulldog Drummond's Secret Police. These two fine talents are linked tonight in a fantastic play by Milton Geiger called Professor Gossamer's Experiment. I'm sure you've never heard about anything quite like what happened to Professor Gossamer's wife. Donald Meek and Elizabeth Patterson in Professor Gossamer's Experiment. Under a single light in his study, Professor Clarence Gossamer is patiently correcting a stack of examination papers. Sophomore English and Comparative Literature, 318. Professor Gossamer's hair is sparse and gray. brushed back from a high forehead. One thing distinguishes this rather ordinary, underpaid, small-town college professor. A curious elfin light glitters in his calm blue eyes, lending a decided zest to his expression. With a sigh, he finishes correcting the last paper. The study door opens. His wife enters the circle of light cast by the one lamp.
Clarence, I've been waiting for you for at least 10 minutes. Are you coming?
Coming? Why, where, Sarah?
You know very well where. Why are you always so evasive?
You know, dear, I must have picked it up in that summer course in diplomatic relations. Illuminating but ruinous to one's moral fiber.
Now that you've enjoyed your little professorial joke, I'd like to go to the movies.
Oh, my dear Sarah.
You've been promising to take me out for 3 months. We've just time to make the last show.
If I could only be sure it's the last.
You promised, and we are going.
Oh, please, Sarah. Another night, eh?
Tonight.
But I prefer other forms of escape, my dear. Besides, I'm very tired. I should like to go to bed.
Sleep, that's all you ever do. Sleep, sleep, sleep. Your students are calling you Horizontal Gossamer, the Sleeping Beauty.
That's really very good, don't you think?
Perhaps, but beside the point. You forget in your very scholarly abstraction that I'm entitled to some diversion. You never take me to the faculty functions, luncheons, open house, nothing.
Will you excuse me this evening, Sarah? Good night.
One moment, Clarence.
Yes?
I think we ought to understand each other right now.
Aren't you being rather suddenly optimistic, Sarah, considering the melancholy fact that we've failed to understand each other in the 14 years of trying?
What? Well, I'm sure I've tried to be a good wife to you.
Oh, I believe you have, Sarah, according to your lights. But the light was bad. No, I don't blame you, really.
Haven't you been happy?
Yes, yes, I have. Lately.
Only lately, huh?
Yes, a rather wonderful thing has happened to me. Something unreal, unearthly.
Clarence Gossamer, whatever in the world are you talking about?
About going to sleep on nights and dreaming.
Dreaming?
Yes, it's a difficult thing to explain. You see, I'm not really very much. By all modern standards, I'm a failure. But I don't mind that, however.
That's ever so clear, my dear professor.
You see, I've been a little man. Laughed at, scorned, ridiculed, ordered about willy-nilly by his very superior superiors, badgered, bullied, and swindled by everyone. I've been patient. Perhaps too patient.
And what has all this ancient history to do with your sleeping o' nights and dreaming?
Everything, Sarah. Everything. When I go to sleep at night, a strange thing happens. I dream.
That's revolutionary.
My dreaming is out of the realm of human experience, I think. I hope.
Oh. Clarence, I have 10 minutes to listen to your nonsense. After that, I shall go to the movies alone.
As you wish. But when I dream, Sarah, something delightful happens to me. Something incredible and priceless to me. I become a leader among men, a strong man, a conqueror, admired and beloved by my people. I am honored. I am consulted. I am respected. In short, I'm everything that I'm not in reality.
Fiddlesticks.
Yes, I suppose so.
You're living in a paradise of illusion.
Illusion? Did you say illusion?
Certainly. You've allowed yourself to become the plumed knight of a nightmare. Forget it.
Forget? Oh, forget it. No, I couldn't. No. There's more to it. It's not so much the dream, Sarah, as the manner of their dreaming. You see, I go to my room and lie on my bed, and presently I'm asleep. And then, I open my eyes. I'm still in my own room. But I get up and walk out of the room and right into my dream. And the dream has continuity, Sarah. Like my daily life. Each night I take up where I left off the night before.
And what were you working on last? Mutual trade agreements?
Please, Sarah, this is important to you, too.
So I begin to suspect. Go on.
Now, here's the point. When my day's work in my dream country is done, I quite deliberately return to my bed and lie down, knowing that the dream is about over. I close my eyes. When I open them again, it's daylight, and I get up and dress and have breakfast and go to the university.
In the slang of your underclassmen, so what?
This, Sarah. I shuttle back and forth between reality and illusion, but which is which?
Well, what's that?
I've told you the manner of my dreaming and waking. One is the same as the other. Then, tell me, which is reality and which is the dream? Am I dreaming now? And will tonight's adventure be reality? Or is this reality? And will I only dream tonight? One is as convincing as the other, Sarah.
Clarence, are you feeling all right?
I never thought it so clearly or coolly in my life. How do we know what is illusion and what is reality? Suppose you and the university and all its howling inmates are figments of a dream. And that tonight I lie down from that dream and return to the world of reality and my leadership in utopia.
Clarence, are you serious? Are you mad?
What is madness, Sarah? My dream world is certainly a saner place than this world is today. In my world, we bomb no cities, murder no children, desecrate no temples.
But this is utterly ridiculous.
Sarah, look into that mirror, the big one.
Well?
No, don't look at me. Look into the mirror. Look closely. Well, what do you see?
Oh, don't be silly. I see my reflection, of course.
Ah, but do you? Or does your reflection see you?
What?
Just that. Which is you and which is the image?
Why, I'm me, of course.
But are you sure? Or are you the reflection of that person on the other side of the mirror? Maybe that thing you see in the mirror lives and breathes and thinks and goes to the mirror of its own free will. And you must obey and go to the mirror because it does. Because you are the reflection.
No, I'm not.
But how can you be sure?
Oh, you must be crazy, Clarence. I won't listen to you another second. I don't know what you're talking about.
Perhaps you do, and you're afraid. Do you know what I'm going to do?
No, I'm not interested.
Oh, yes, you are. Because I'm going to perform a little experiment, and it concerns you, Sarah.
But me? Well, how can it?
Have you ever dreamed, Sarah, knowing all the time it was a dream?
Yes. Yes, of course. Why?
And haven't you told yourself, this is a dream, I shall wake up now, haven't you?
Why, yes.
Well, I'm going to make an experiment. I'm going to find out. If this should be the illusion and that thing on the other side of sleep the reality, then I might dismiss everything about me with a wave of the hand. Even you, Sarah.
Clarence, you must have a fever. Let me...
No. This is a dream. I'm tired of the night's dreaming. It is time I got back to my empire.
When I have the time, I shall return and look further into this dream about being a professor in a stodgy Middle West town. But not now, not now.
Clarence. Oh, what am I going to do? Clarence.
You, Sarah. Go away. You are part of the illusion. Part of the dream. You are first. So go away.
Clarence Gossamer, go away. Stop his nonsense at once.
Go away.
Stop it, I say.
Go away.
It's utterly insane.
Go away.
I'll report your strange behavior to the university board.
Go
Clarence,
away.
Do you hear me?
Go away.
Clarence!
Go away.
Clarence!
Go away.
I insist that you see
go
this
away.
Child's face.
Go
you hear
away.
Me?
Go Clarence. Away.
I won't tolerate this
go
another.
Go away.
You hear me, Clarence? Clarence! I can't see you. Where are you? Where are you? Where are you?
Sarah. Sarah. Sarah.
Contrary wise, my dear Sarah. Where are you? Gone. Gone, just as I thought. Just as I thought. Gone. I was right.
Or was I? Ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, what do you think?
Great many of you have asked us to describe Jane Warren. Until Mr. Golden presents her to you on the screen, I can simply say that although she's 15, she might pass for a young woman of 17 or 18. She's quite dark, with a very attractive face. Dark eyes that smile and twinkle as she sings. The amazing thing about her work is that she sings with apparently no effort, and a decided joy and zest in so doing. Tonight she chooses the popular hit, The Umbrella Man, Jane Warren.
Umbrellas, 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 toodle-lama-lama, toodle-lama-lama, any umbrellas, any umbrellas to fix today. Bring your parasol, it may be small, it may be big. He repairs them all with what you call a thingamajig. Pitter-patter-patter, pitter-patter-patter, it looks like rain. Let it pitter-patter, let it pitter-patter, don't mind the rain. He'll mend your umbrella, then go on his way. Singing toodle-lama-lama, toodle-ay, toodle-lama-lama, toodle-ay. Any umbrellas to fix today. When there's a lull and things are dull, shove a knife from the wise in the neighborhood. And he's very good. He'll don a sock or set a clock, an apple cart, a broken heart. He mends everything, but he'd rather sing.
In the past year, people all over America have the Rudy Valley Hour continues after a brief pause for station identification.
WEAF, New York.
Have you an answer yet for Professor Gossamer's question? If you have, you know more than any philosopher has ever found out. However, we digress. On the road ahead, we shall meet Paul Garretts, the King's Men, and Barney Grant in
the Rudy Valley Hour, Act Two, presented by Fleischmann's new high vitamin yeast.
It is our earnest effort on this hour to avoid the stereotyped, the standard, the time-worn path, particularly in the way of comedy, which affords as good a prologue as you could find to the announcement, here is Paul Garretts, bringing a cargo of tall stories.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The first story tonight is about a friend of mine who went into a grocery store on his way home from work. He went up to the clerk and he said, "My wife told me to get some Bransy buns, Bitsy bite size. Two packages, please." Clerk said, "I'm sorry, sir, but we're all out of Bransy buns. How about some crinkly wispies, malty walties, ricelets, cornsy pornsies, or Edie Wheatums?" Fella said, "No," she said, "I should get some Bransy buns, Bitsy bite size." So the clerk said, "Well, I'm sure she'd be just as pleased with some cheesy wheezies, ginger bits, itsy cakes, or sweetie toofums." So the fellow said as he toddled over toward the meat department, "Oh, goodness, you've got me all mixed up. I'll come back as soon as I buy some pickled pigsy tootsies." Well, that should really put us all in a juvenile mood, so if you'll straighten your pinafores and pull up your cribs, I'll tell you a story about a very devoted family of hippopotami. Hippopotami, in case you're curious, is the Phi Beta Kappa word for hippopotamuses, which in turn means more than one hippopotamus. There's no extra charge for this exciting information. This is a story about a little hippopotamus who wanted to fly. He lived in a zoo with his father and mother. His name was Horace. They lived right next to the big cage where all the birds were, and Horace used to watch the birds all day long, and he got the idea that he wanted to fly too. His father and mother kept telling him how silly that was, but Horace just said, "I don't care. I'm just as graceful as those birds are, and no matter what you say, someday I'm going to fly." So his mother said, "If you keep talking such nonsense, I'll tell the keeper not to give you any lunch." Now, Horace knew that lunch that day was to be his favorite dish, which was turnip greens, meatballs, and hay. So he got very angry and decided to be a brat. So he went over in the corner and covered himself all over with straw so nobody could find him, and there he was, sulking and pouting in the corner. When lunchtime came, his mother said to his father, "I wonder where Horace is." But his father just grunted and kept on swallowing cabbages. Just then, one of those small dirigibles or blimps flew over the zoo, and it had a long trailer or banner streaming out behind it with some advertising matter on it. Mrs. Hippo saw the blimp, and she said, "Why, there's Horace, and he's flying, too. He said he would, and now he's really doing it." So his father looked up, and he said, "Gee, that's funny. We've had Horace almost a year now, and that's the first time I ever noticed that his tail spells eat at Jake's Diner." While we're prying into the domestic lives of our four-footed friends, I may as well tell you about another problem child. This is a story about a little goat and his mother who were running through the woods one day, as goats will, and as we all do, they became weary and they sat down to rest. After a little while, the mother noticed that the poor kid had sat down on a patch of cactus, and he didn't seem to mind it at all. She said, "My goodness, how can you sit there on that cactus without complaining? Doesn't it hurt?" And the little kid says, "No, I don't feel a thing. I guess I must be just a dead-end kid." By this time, you may think that I've spent most of my life in caves and trees and couldn't tell a story about people if I wanted to. Well, I could if I wanted to, and suddenly I feel that I want to. So here's a story about two men. This little episode concerns two somewhat irresponsible gentlemen to whom life was slightly less than an empty bowl of cherries. Their names were Mortimer and Stragmore. Stragmore came to visit Mortimer one day, and he said, "Oh, I'm so glad you came, because I've got a new game I want to show you." So they went down to the game room. When they got there, Mortimer clapped his hands, and the butler came out and set up a great big mirror against the wall. A beautiful thing with a silver frame. And he handed Mortimer a brick. So Mortimer wound up like Dizzy Dean, and he took the brick and smashed the mirror all to bits. So he clapped his hands again, and the butler set up another mirror. This one had a gold frame. So he took another brick, and he smashed that. Then he turned to Stragmorth, and he said, "Isn't it fun?" So Stragmorth said, "Well, it seems to be, but isn't it a little expensive?" So Mortimer said, "Why, no, I only pay a penny apiece for those bricks." And here's a little fairy tale. Once upon a time, a lady had two little goldfish in a bowl. One was named Herbert, and the other was named Gladys. But Herbert and Gladys were always fighting and making so much noise that nobody in the house could get any sleep. So the lady got an idea. She got one of those glass silexes that they use for making drip coffee, and she made a double-decker bowl with Gladys on top and Herbert in the bottom. So it worked fine. No more fights. Everything was peaceful as the two little fish swam around, each in their own half of the silex. Until one day the lady noticed that Herbert, down in the bottom, looked kind of lonesome. So she went out and got another goldfish named Sonia and put her in with Herbert to keep him company. And Herbert fell in love with Sonia. Well, one day Gladys got to feeling very lonely, too, and she called out to Herbert. She said, "Herbert, why don't you drip up and see me sometime?" And Herbert said, "Why, haven't you heard about me being married? I can't come up there. I'm out of percolation." Well, that's that. Oh, yes. Before I go, I must tell you this. It's a little thing about two drunks who went to a hotel. They went up to the clerk and they asked him for a bed with two rooms. Well, they finally settled for a room with two beds and they went upstairs to sleep. A little while later, they were both seen, fully dressed, stretched out on the one bed, trying to sleep. And the one drunk says to the other, "It's seldom what happens on these hotel beds." He said, "What do you know? There's a guy in this bed with me." And the other drunk said, "Since you mention it, there's a guy in this bed with me, too. How do you like that?" So the other fellow says, "What do you say we kick him out, huh?" He said, "All right, let's." So there was the sound of a terrific struggle and a heavy thud. The one drunk said, "Hey, Jack, I kicked mine out. How did you do?" The other fellow says, "Not so good. He was too much for me. He kicked me out." So the first drunk says, "Well, that's all right, pal. You come and sleep with me."
A mother and wife, puzzled like many other mothers and wives. Another cake before your evening meal. Get a supply in the morning of Fleischmann's new high vitamin yeast.
Vinton Friedley is the proud producer of the highest grossing musical comedy to reach New York's White Wave. Leave It to Me. With Billy Gaxton, Victor Moore, Sophie Tucker, Tamara. Words and music by Cole Porter. We present a medley of the entire score in their order. From now on, Most Gentlemen Don't Like Love, Get Out of Town, and Tomorrow. You'll probably be hearing a lot of these, as Cole Porter songs are always played a great deal, and you'll enjoy them the more you hear them. With the assistance of Carol Gould and the vocal ensemble, the Cole Porter score from Leave It to Me.
From now on, no more philandering, no more hot spots, no scatterbrain. From now on, my fun will be meandering with my darling down Lover's Lane. The old gang will never know me when they find I've become the kind people call homie. No more yearn for something new, dear. My address is you, dear, from now on.
Most gentlemen don't like love. They just like to kick it around. Most gentlemen can't take love, 'cause most gentlemen can't be profound. As Madam Sappho in some sonnet said, a slap and a tickle
is all that the fickle male ever has in his head. For most gentlemen don't like love. I've been in love, so I know what I'm talking of, and oh, to my woe, I have found they just like to kick it around.
Get out of town before it's too late, my love. Get out of town, be good to me, please. Why wish me harm? Why not retire to a farm and be contented to charm the birds off the tree? Just disappear. I care for you too much. And when you are near, close to me, dear, we touch too much. The thrill when we meet is so bittersweet that, darling, it's getting me down. So on your mark, get set, get out of town.
Biography of band leaders will recall that the great white father, Paul Whiteman, whipped up in an earlier day two notorious vocal groups, the same being the Rhythm Boys and the King's Men. One third of the Rhythm Boys has since achieved widespread notoriety under the name of Crosby. All four of the King's Men are still very much together in the picture business lately. Since our arrival on the coast, they have assisted us mightily and nightly, both here and at the Grove. You hear them a moment ago, you heard them a moment ago in this Cole Porter medley, and they deserve, we feel, a spotlight presentation. They report down front now, bearing a taradiddle entitled Figaro, the King's Men.
We shall give a concert if it kills us.
If it kills them.
And how it will.
For we love to sing the classic opera arias.
Shall we sing of Rigoletto?
No, Pagliaccio.
I say Figaro.
Figaro, 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 Figaro.
Figaro.
Figaro, 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 Figaro. La, 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 la. How the ladies crowd his beauty shop.
La, 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 la.
Figaro, 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 Figaro. La, 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 la. What a barber. Yes, sir, he's the top. La, 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 la. He is handsome, debonair. How they fight to get his chair, just to have him do their lovely hair. All the barbers stand and sigh as the ladies pass them by.
You can bet they know the reason why.
Figaro, 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 Figaro. La, 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 la. Says the lovely blonde and dark brunette. La, 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 la. Figaro, 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 Figaro.
La, 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 la.
What a lady's pet is Figaro, 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 Figaro.
La, 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 la,
la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la. Decollete, negligee.
La 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 la.
Listen to everyone calling him.
Everyone calling him.
Grabbing and mauling him.
Grabbing and mauling him.
How he's enslaving them.
How he's enslaving them.
Permanent waving them.
Permanent waving them.
Figaro here.
Figaro there.
Figaro there.
Figaro here.
La 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 la
la la la la la la la la la
la la la la la la la la la la la la la. What a prolific consortium of wonders.
Figaro, 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 Figaro.
Figaro.
La, 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 la.
To which we add Barney Grant. 2 weeks ago, Barney explained that he is not a hillbilly. He is, he claims, a scissorbill. A scissorbill being a hillbilly who can read writing. The learned Mr. Grant approaches.
Well, thanks, Mr. Bally. I sure am glad to be back with you again. Did you get along all right while I was gone?
Fine, Barney. Why do you ask?
Well, I've been kind of worried about the program, you know, and me not being here to help you and all that. And I've been worrying so much, I've been losing sleep. Why, the other night I got to stewing, fretting about it, and got so hot I had to get up and take off my socks. Well, there's a spell last week I didn't sleep for 3 days.
You mean to say you didn't get any sleep for 3 days and nights?
Well, I've been doing all right on my night sleeping, but I had to cut out my naps. But I sure am glad to be back with you.
We're glad to have you back with us.
I'm excited about it, too. I've been so excited since last August the 4th.
And what happened August 4th?
Well, we had a big celebration down in Thunderbolt. You see, the mayor's son was 21 years old, and a gang of us got together and caught him and put shoes on him. Was you going to say something, Mr. Valley?
That must have been some celebration.
It's almost as exciting as the day we had the mule herder's picnic.
The mule herder's picnic?
Well, didn't I ever tell you about that?
No.
Well, there's some carrying on at that picnic. We had roasting ears and some marshmallows and some baked spuds. And then we had a mess of stuff, you know. Everything was going along just fine. And one of the women folks spoke up and she says, "Fellers, we ain't got no coleslaw."
What? No coleslaw?
That's right, Mr. Valley. No coleslaw. So I just took the matter into my own hands. I called over to Shug Wilson, and I said, Shug, run over into old man Beasley's cabbage patch and get a cabbage for some coleslaw. He said, how big a cabbage shall I get? I said, I'll get one about as big as your head. Well, about 5 minutes later, old man Beasley come running up to me, and he says, if you don't get that fella out of my cabbage patch, I'm going to shoot him. I said, well, what's wrong? He said, why, he's pulling up all my cabbages and trying his hat on them. Was you going to say something, Mr. Valley?
I was just going to ask you when all this happened.
July 18th, 1936.
You seem to have quite a memory, Barney.
Shucks, I got a memory like a steel trap. Well, I can recollect what I did all the way back to last Saturday.
Some recollecting.
Shucks, it ain't as easy as you think. Can you recollect what you did last Saturday, exactly?
Why, yes. In the morning, we motored to Lake Tahoe.
Uh-huh.
Golfed until noon, lunched under the trees, boated till dusk.
My, my.
Then we canoed up the river and weekended there.
Boy, you had a slick time, you know it.
What did you do?
Well, in the morning, we horsed into town and whittled all afternoon. Then we muled out to the hayfield and jeehawed till dusk. After that, we suffered and tobaccoed for a spell. And then we staircased up to the attic and bedsteaded till dawn. Was you going to say something, Mr. Valley?
You had a slick time, too.
Oh, it's just the gypsy in me, I guess. Light-hearted and gay, just like the way you sing your songs, Mr. Valley.
Thank you, Barney. So you like my singing?
Like it? Why, Mr. Valley, when you sing, your voice is so soft and so sweet and so mealy-mouthed and...
Just a moment, just a moment. What do you mean, mealy-mouthed?
Oh, you know, Mr. Valley, mealy-mouthed, like you're in love or something like that. Have you ever felt mealy-mouthed, Mr. Valley?
Why, no, I can't say that I have.
You ain't been around much, have you?
Have you?
Well, haven't you noticed I've been acting kind of mealy-mouthed here tonight?
Oh, listen, don't tell me the love bug has bitten you.
Well, I think he's been nibbling on me a little bit.
When did this happen?
Oh, when we were throwing rocks in the river.
What has throwing rocks in the river got to do with feeling mealy-mouthed?
Well, you recollect me telling you about taking up with that chorus gal.
Oh, yes, I believe I do, yes.
Well, I went out with her the other night and walked right into one of them air restaurants. I'm a regular playboy. Paid her check, too. Well, she wanted me to take her to one of them air nightclubs, but I just wouldn't do it. Why, it was too late. It must have been around 10:30.
Well, don't you know that the real fun doesn't begin in a nightclub until about 3 in the morning?
3 in the morning?
Yes.
Gosh, I'm going to get up early some morning and just go to one. Well, anyway, after we had our snack, I asked her if she'd like to go down to the river and throw rocks. That's an old Scissor Bill custom, throwing rocks in the river. So she said, well, it's kind of dark, ain't it? I said, uh-huh. It's a dark, you can't see the river. She said, well, if you can't see the river, how can you throw rocks in it? I said, well, we can hear them splash, can't we? So we went down to the river and threw rocks for about an hour, and finally we just ran out of rocks. And she kind of looked up at me and she said, well, why don't you do something?
What did you do?
Oh, I went and got some more rocks. Was you going to say something, Mr. Valley?
I was going to say that I can see that you're the Casanova of the Corn Belt.
Shucks, ain't nothing. You know, I had that mealy mouth feeling so bad that I made up a song about that gal.
Don't mean to tell you you're a composer.
Well, I don't know nothing about that, but I made up a song about her. And here it is. Just let her flicker, fellas. One and two and one and two. There's a gal lives down our way. Her name is Lizzie Gray. Oh, there ain't so very much to Liz, but what there is. She don't use powder, don't use paint. She don't want to look like what she ain't. There ain't so very much to Liz, what there is. She hides her knees in the gingham frock. When she walks, you can hear them knock. There ain't so very much to Liz, what there is. She used to have the cutest chin. Now the darn thing has a twin. There ain't so very much to Liz, what there is. Her mouth's like huskin' corn, I fear. I mean, it goes from ear to ear. There ain't so very much to Liz. What there is, there is. Get poor Liz out in a gale. With her big ears, she'd soon set sail. There ain't so very much to Liz. What there is, there is. Her paw is big and rough and tough. He wears a number 10 handcuff. There ain't so very much to Liz. What there is, there is. I could sing a Liz all night long, but there's no sense to this darn song. There ain't so very much to Liz. What there is, there is. My sweet patootie, I hear you talking. I'm here to tell you, I don't mean maybe. Sweet dog face, that is all there is. That's all.
Here's why many people are nervous, run down.
You say you love me, you swear that you do. But how can you love me and be so untrue? Oh, what do you know about love? You say you mean it, how happy we'll be. But how can you mean it and be mean to me? Oh, what do you know about love? It's funny when you hold me tight. It thrills me so much, it's a sin. A sweetheart, when you hold me tight, that isn't love, it's the mood that you're in.
Next week, our cast is headed by two visitors from the East, Cornelia Otis Skinner and Colonel Stupnagel. The Valley Company goes into its third week at the Ambassador Coconut Grove. This is Rudy Valley bidding you all good night.
Heard on tonight's program was September Song from Knickerbocker Holiday. This is the National Broadcasting Company.